It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hello, beautiful listeners. It's your host, Tembi Lopp. Welcome to Lifted, a podcast that pulls back the curtain on creativity, resilience, and the extraordinary moments when everything changes. My guest is an unstoppable force. Chef Jenny Dorsey is an author, a speaker, and a graduate of Harvard University's master's program in education. She specializes in using food for social good. Her work focuses around enabling the food industry to see itself as a driver of social impact and change. She is the executive director of Studio ATAO, an award-winning nonprofit think tank. And Jenny and her work have been profiled on the Food Network, Oxygen TV, as well as in Food and Wine and Harper's Bazaar. Her conversation was riveting. She shared how bringing vulnerability to her dining experiences and curating more meaningful, informed, and even creative experiences that confront the complexities and discomfort of food and identity is what she loves. Her mission is to use the culinary arts as a platform to evoke empathy and real emotion, and sometimes make people feel uncomfortable. As she says, that's the point. Hello, Chef Jenny. Welcome to the Lifted Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me today.
I'm going to dive right in. I love to talk about people's origin story as sort of a way in to all things that they do in the world as adult people. So I know you were born in Shanghai, you were raised in Seattle. What did your parents do for a living? And was food a big part of your childhood?
Yeah, so both my parents are PhDs in molecular and cellular biology, one and the other. So they were scientists. So growing up, I spent a lot of my formative years in labs. I feel like the smell of the lab is like permanently in the back of my mind, like the sound of like latex gloves snapping. They were doing a lot of research on cancer. So unfortunately, I had to see lots of mice and rats as part of that process. A lot of the like agitator for bacteria, like that was formative childhood memories. So as part of that, food was not really like, or I guess the food industry was not really a consideration in terms of a career trajectory. It was always, you know, if you really want to go into science, you could go into science, though my parents saw a lot of academic racism in science. So they didn't always encourage me to go into the hard sciences, but they did encourage me to go into things like business or law, you know, the kind of classic sort of immigrant parent sort of idea of what success looks like. So food was a really important thing for community. Food was something to have fun with, but food was never a thought even of something you can actually make money doing or, you know, have a livelihood from.
So what are some of your early food memories in your home? And, yes. And I'm thinking specifically of a story I heard you share. I think this is in your teen years. So this may be a little bit later around the lunchbox.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think growing up, food was, as I said, it was definitely like an important thing to always have. It was a source of kind of pride and joy. A lot of times when we had potlucks, community potlucks, you know, all the aunties were having a low key competition on who made the best this or that, you know, who had leftovers at the end of the night. If, you know, if your plate had leftovers, like people didn't like it. So there was always that undercurrent where food was definitely a source of how people was able to show parts of their character to others. My mom, being a scientist, had always been more interested in baking. I think the scientific methods of measuring things, weighing things really appealed to her. She's a great savory cook as well, but I think like she always gravitated towards that. So making things like cold mung bean noodles, which had very exacting requirements, I think she could really, you know, show her abilities that way. So that was very cool to see, even though I might not have processed all of what I just said until later in the years. But for me, growing up as a Chinese American, like immigrant child, food was also definitely a point of contention. It was something that I loved eating at home. And at the same time, when I went to school, I could very visibly see that some of the things that I liked eating were not celebrated or embraced by my peers or even my teachers in the way they were in the communities I was part of. And so I think every immigrant child has their lunchbox story. And I definitely had a fair share, multiple memories of just, you know, bringing I had this little pink thermos that had three little layers, and my mom would like pack it with things. And she was a working mom, so she would pack it with things that were yummy but relatively easy for her to make, and they were often Chinese in origin. And people would say like, oh, that's gross, or you know, you would hear all of these really negative feedback from your peers. And it's so heartbreaking, because even though I knew I liked this food, you know, I love my mom's pork belly, I love the like mustard greens and rice, you love it at home, but you feel embarrassed or ashamed to love it out loud in public. And so there are so many instances of me throwing my food away and then not eating anything. Or I was also on reduced lunch. And so whenever I was buying lunch, the amount of shame and guilt that reduced lunch kids have to go through is a whole, I mean, separate issue of just constantly feeling like my food choices were not only an identifying marker of who I was, but a negative one at that, and not really having the vocabulary or the words or the kind of educational structure to understand what that meant, especially in the context of, you know, racism and xenophobia and all the other social issues, classism that we have in our society imposed on very young children.
A part of what you shared reminds me of the concept of duality, and that sense of I can enjoy this at home, and it is loving, and it is nurturing, and it is giving, and it is generative in all the ways. And yet I walk out of my door and that same thing takes on a whole new quality. And now I reject it. And I know many people, not just immigrants, but African-Americans have right. America asks us often to walk that path of like, you know, there's what you do and then there's what you do. Mm-hmm. So your mom mostly cooked at home. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm assuming then if they were talking about sort of the career, the traditional trajectory of like lawyer or become a doctor or go into business, it wasn't a career in the culinary arts, in the food, in the industry that is food. Was that on your radar at all as a child?
No, not at all. And kind of similar to what you were saying, I think it was a lot of code switching. So like you can like food, you can like this food, you can like all of these things in this context, which is within the home. And that is where it was confined. You can find joy in this thing, but it was only to be kind of enjoyed inside. And then once you're in the presence of the world outside white people, right, then you aren't really allowed to do that, because that way that prevents you from assimilating. And so similarly, even if you poured your heart into cooking inside and found a lot of joy and identity that way, that was not allowed or accepted in kind of the wider world, because that wasn't seen as a sign of success. And in particular for, I think, my parents, it wasn't seen as the what they wanted as the goal for all this sacrifice and hard work for themselves. So, and there's an unhealthy amount, I think, of transference of their own desires onto their child. I'm an only child, and they're working through that. I think a lot of parents in general, not just immigrant parents, but parents in general, are working through extricating their identity from their children's identity. I mean, it's a process. And my parents definitely struggled with that. I remember asking my mom when I was probably my late teens, you know, what she wanted to do if she weren't a scientist. And she said, you know, I have no idea. I never thought about it, because she didn't really feel like she had an option. She only could do this one thing that could get her out of the country into safety and have a stable enough life. And all they wanted to see as this external marker of you did it right, right? They wanted to feel validated in their choices is to have their child go do the career, have the career that they thought would be successful. And there's an element of outside competition as well within the community of like, my child does this and my child does that, of each of them kind of hoping to validate their own anxieties of, did I parent right? Did I live my life correctly?
Similarly, just as an anecdotal side share, my late husband was a chef, and for my family who had sort of transcended the Jim Crow South and segregation and entered into squarely into the middle class and into the professional class, the idea that I would marry a cook was like, wait, what is actually happening? Did we rate? No, this is not a thing. So I understand that. And I appreciate you sharing that because I think it is not an uncommon thing. The classism around what professions are deemed successful or worthy, or, you know, in those are things that children deal with in this country. That is a part of the classism that's embedded in America. So I thank you for sharing that. I know that you worked in management consultant in the fashion industry. I know that you entered Columbia for an MBA. And I know that there was a moment when you were like, this is not my path. Take us to that moment or series of moments that led you to say, "This, I'm not becoming a fashion consultant and I'm not going to get an MBA. I'm going to go work in food."
Yeah, I think there was really, I think, a series of small and large moments that all kind of culminated together in this resounding dread of, if I am not at all excited about my future, then like something is very wrong. So I went into management consulting right out of college. It was kind of seen as the sexy thing to do. And I went to college in Seattle. So being able to land a job right out of college in New York was like, ooh, so glamorous, you know? And I was very much fixated on this idea of, oh, I want to have this perfect LinkedIn profile. I want to be fashionable all the time. I want to, you know, look nice and be thin. Being thin was also a very big part of that. Definitely struggled with disordered eating, as had a very kind of, you know, complicated relationship with food as part of that process. Because again, even though I love food, love cooking at home, eating at work or enjoying food at work was so frowned upon. It was seen so negatively at work that I also internalized, like, well, I can't possibly fit here and I can't possibly be a good management consultant, right? If I like food, everyone I see around me is so thin and they don't eat lunch. And that's what is held up as kind of the gold standard of, if you really care about, if you're committed to this industry, this is not a thing that you enjoy. So there was that internal tension of, I love food. And then I would start, I went through like a binge eating phase, and I actually went to a hypnotherapist for my binge eating. So anyway, that was a whole other, that's a segment, but that was also a series of events of like constantly having this internal tension, this internal unrest of what I like and what I want versus what I felt I had to like or want or act like. And then on top of that, going to Columbia, I essentially was buying myself time to figure out what I wanted to do. I had always liked cooking. And so I was taking these recreational cooking classes while I was struggling with my eating issues, which is, it's just giant oxymoron, right? Like my life was an oxymoron, honestly. And I think that psychic tension is what drives people into things of anxiety and depression. You do not have a holistic or a cohesive identity because you're constantly catering to what other people want you to look like. And you're so out of touch with how your body feels or how you want to feel. And so anyway, I was part of this. I was taking these cooking classes and I was like, oh, you know, I should go to culinary school. And I wanted to do that. And I was like, but I need a safety net. I can't possibly actually go work in the food industry. That's an outrageous idea. So I ended up applying early to Columbia Business School, and I got in December of 2011. And so I actually had about 9 months before I would be matriculated into the program in August of 2012. And so during that time, I went to culinary school. I went in, I was like, you know, I have to be part of this class because it graduates before school starts. Here's, just put it on my credit card, you know, despite being a finance major, clearly did not know how to make sound money decisions. That 17.9 APY was perfect on my culinary school debt. Love that. And so went to culinary school and thought it'd be a creative outlet. It'd be fun. And very quickly realized, wow, I was learning about food and there was a lot of problems with culinary school and just the embedded racism and sexism and all of that, that we can talk about in a second. But I think what I unexpectedly learned was, wow, there's actually a different way to live outside of kind of the social norms that I had been accustomed to coming out of undergrad, where it's always about being around people that would help you professionally, kind of being in the right places, having the perfect LinkedIn profile, thinking about your next promotion, constantly trying to climb this corporate ladder to this idea of success that I didn't know if I really believed in, but it's the only idea of success I've ever been sold. And so as an impressionable 19-year-old, what am I supposed to be? How do I imagine, right, outside of the fold? I was never encouraged to imagine. I was told to kind of follow this because then you'll be happy. I don't know what happy means in this context, right? But somehow at some point you will feel that way. And knowing that I didn't feel that way, and suddenly in culinary school, it was hard and I was very tired. And some days were not very fun when you're fabricating meat for 8 hours and you just, it's hot in your summer and the smell, it's not great. And yet I really found camaraderie in the group of people that I was with. And because I was taking evening class, most people were older, they were career changers, and they really had a different set of values that I was used to. And so I'm still good friends with some of these people. Like they really shared with me, I think, a perspective of the world that I've never seen before. And it gave me the idea to even imagine what a different world could look like for me, or a different career, or at least gave me the permission to try to dream or of something a little bit different for myself, and perhaps, you know, try that or like put my tippy toe in. And so I graduated culinary school 3 days and that before I started at business school. And I think the stark juxtaposition of those two things also very much reinforced in me this like corporate environment, this constant kind of, what is the right word? This kind of like, you know, when you're like trying to see like one-upping one another is not what I wanted to be part of. And it's also not the way I wanted to interact with the world or build relationships anymore. Those are not people that were my friends. They've never been my friends. And they never will really be my friends. Like we are all, we treat each other as pawns, and that is all we can ever be to each other in that context, because we're committed to this idea that we're always playing this final game where there's a winner and a loser. So that all kind of pushed me to like, I need to leave. I need to at least give myself the permission, the opportunity and chance to explore something different and see what might happen. And I don't know what might happen, but it was an opportunity to finally feel like I had some semblance of control in my life.
Your share just solidified for me. You helped me to articulate the fact that I've always thought that the kitchen and restaurants and working together to make a meal, have a restaurant sing, and theater are very, very similar insofar as you cannot work against each other. You absolutely have to work together. The actor, you know, is only lit if the lighting person is lighting them. If the lighting person is working against the actor and they're competing, you're never going to have a show. Right? You're never going to have a meal if the line cook and the prep cook are not helping the person who's finishing the plate at the end. And I think that that sense of community, I think everyone at some point, no matter what career you find yourself in, should find some collaborative art form to work within, because it will change your mindset. And you can bring that into a traditional corporate environment and hopefully change it and better it. But it sounds like your experience, that, as you said, that stark juxtaposition between a very collaborative space where people do help each other out a lot, and then going into a hyper-competitive capitalistic ladder was a lot. I could see why you would be like, yeah, let me rethink this. So, but then what made you decide, or what was like that first shift when you're like, no to the MBA right now? I need to stay inside of the food industry. And we could talk about why it's an industry later, you know, and how that differs from the culinary arts, because two things are happening. It's both an industry and an art, right? Who or what was the first person that said, go here, do this first. Here's the first step.
Yeah, I think for me, because I had already been enrolled in culinary school, the first step was to do an externship, which, if folks are not familiar, is basically an unpaid internship at a restaurant. It doesn't have to be at a restaurant, but often it's in restaurants. You could hypothetically also go to, you know, a food styling studio or something like that. For me, I had always been interested in fine dining. And I think I'm sure there's a lot of psychological reasons for that. One of it is just pure artistry. You know, the plates are really beautiful, all that stuff. But I think also, as someone who's comes from a background, at least in the States, where Chinese food is often not seen as, you know, fine dining, is not seen as beautiful, is not seen as worthy of being expensive, or even worthy of being celebrated. I wanted to know what was in these fine dining, like what is happening? How is this food that is being cooked there so special or important or differentiated? Like, what's their secret sauce? I think there was like a rabid curiosity there. What makes it quote unquote better? Because from what I can tell, I didn't see any difference, right? I don't see any difference with the kinds of technical skills either. I think it's just a different set of skills. So I went into fine dining and learned a lot. Like, there's a lot of cool things happening in fine dining, and just kind of this idea of how to constantly encourage your diners to want a little bit more. So one of the best things that I heard the pastry chef at Atelier Cran say was, we were kind of tasting a dish and talking about the portion size of the dish. And something he mentioned was, you always want something to be like, when the server comes and takes dish away, that the diner will say, like, is thinking to themselves, maybe not say out loud, I wish I could have just one more bite. So there's like a kind of a sense of longing of, as the chef, it is about making the food, executing it consistently, making sure it comes at the right temperature at the right time, but it's also about managing the guest experience and feeling so that the guest isn't oversatiated or undersatiated. They're not too drunk, they're not too whatever it is, but that they're always a little, like, they're always like thinking, longing for a little bit more, so that you're kind of on their mind, that they will remember that experience with a great fondness, and also not be able to necessarily replicate or recreate it. So it kind of has an aura of mystery to it. So there was a lot of, I think, that sort of, it's hard to pinpoint what exactly it is. It's all the culmination of the little things that makes fine dining special, or good fine dining special. So that was a really important experience for me. But then at the same time, you go into an industry where you see people are working for free, they're mistreated, they're working long hours, a lot of folks are undocumented, and there's no way that restaurants could make money. Most restaurants could make money otherwise. This industry is propped up because of our long history of slavery. There's no other way our industry would have kind of said, oh, it's totally fine that most of our workers are completely unpaid, right? And so there's so much under the surface that are deliberately quite hidden from consumers. And then once you're in the industry as one of the cogs of the wheel, then it's kind of up to you of like, what is my positionality here? Like, what can I realistically do to affect change? Or do I just assimilate and accept it because I don't have any other options? And it's a lot of, you must have a lot of privilege to say, I don't like this and I want to do something about it. Because for many other folks, there's no chance, there's no real opportunity for them to do that. If they were working multiple jobs and they're just trying to scrape by and provide for their kids, they don't have the time or the luxury to say, you know what we need to do? We need to organize our workers together. We need to write a letter to management. We need to do all these things. That they see this as the system, they're presented with the system, and they feel, okay, I just have to accept it as is. So that was also something that I was grappling with as a very young stage, is where do I fit? Do I just want to keep my head down and kind of figure out how to work within this little nightmare that unfortunately I'm in now, making, you know, $9 an hour peeling mushrooms? Or do I want to do something? And if I'm going to do something, what realistically does that even look like?
There's so much to unpack in what you said. And again, the history of restaurants in America, not being the least of it. And I think more people should sort of begin to understand and what that means, and that whole conversation and how it affects labor, and the concept that we consider people in the restaurant industry, quote unquote, unskilled laborers. You know, and yet their work is like the most essential. How is it unskilled and essential? You know, but so here you're in this fine dining experience, right? As you know, in your stage, and you are seeing the sort of way in which they're creating longing for the consumer, for the customer, which always means keeping them slightly unsatisfied, which has echoes of capitalism and consumerism, right? It's just, you always want just a little bit more. Just you're never quite satisfied, right? Keeps you coming back. That is a very specific concept and model and way of being. Whereas many cultures, food is to satisfy. It is actually like at home, I eat it because it feels good and I'm full and then I'm happy and I'm done until the next meal, right? But in the fine dining experiences, if something else is happening, right, which is driving a business for a particular kind of client. I love that you used that as grist for the mill to sort of begin to think about what you would do in the world and how you might engage, combat, change, challenge that. And I want to talk a little bit about your nonprofit, right? Can you tell us about Studio ATAO, what it means, what it does, its origin?
Yeah, for sure. So Studio ATAO, we are a small nonprofit research and advocacy organization that works at the intersection of food, beverage, hospitality, and social justice. So what that looks like is we have a lot of kind of different arms, but it's about kind of identifying, defining, executing, implementing, encouraging better standards, more equitable standards for the food industry. And we do that through our own research that we conduct, and then we publish, synthesize, and then publish out, make it available for folks to understand various issues within food, beverage, hospitality. We also do a lot of educational content. So literally giving vocabulary terms, kind of unraveling these systems that often are all around us, but we don't know how to explain them to other people, or we see them and they make us feel a certain way, but we've never been taught what they are or why they are. And so we don't know how to deal with what we're experiencing besides ignore it or undermine it, or perhaps, you know, say it's something else, marginalize it in some way. And then we also do community grassroots organizing. So actually gathering workers, getting them to talk about what they need, trying to give them more tools, resources, power, so that they can kind of affect change in their own ways. Because one of the kind of our big philosophies is that change, a better change, more equitable change has to come from the ground up. And it has to come from the people who are the most affected by that right now, not the people that are already in power, who are literally benefiting from the system being the way it is. You know, I love to poke fun at things like the Davos Convention, where you have all the richest and most powerful people talking about all the problems that are so terrible that they have been making all their money on. I mean, gosh, they're, I'm sure, in a big hurry to solve those problems, right? It's just a great irony. And that's how the nonprofit industrial complex works. So we are very much aware that we're also operating a big system that is problematic. So it is, again, as you've said, the duality of how do we see the system that we are in, try to fix it, and do it in a way to model the behavior that we hope to see in other people, which is, you know, worker-led interventions, worker-led change, change that is taking from the people that are directly impacted right now and pushing that through the top, as opposed to a top-down idea of a paternalistic model of change, of where whoever's in charge now says, you know, I think this would benefit people, and executing it like that.
This began in your home. You began having dinner parties. It evolved. And one of the things that you have talked about is the soft power of food. So you invite people in, you would cook for them. You as the chef, right, who was giving the food, who was preparing the food, inviting people. There was a deeper discussion you wanted to have about the food that you couldn't quite have in the moment, and that you had to bring your own vulnerability to the table, literally, so that people could experience food in a new way. And that, tell us about that process, and then how that process became formalized into the nonprofit, if I'm understanding the arc.
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of what I mentioned about modeling behavior, I think it's very easy to say, we should do this, you should do this, you know, and tell other people. It's much harder to hold yourself to those same standards and actually be modeling them or imagining them and doing them and trying them and failing at them publicly when very few people around you are doing the same. And so for me as the chef, I was always kind of saying it's really important for us to be not only showing cultural heritage, that's important, but also talking about bigger social messages and all of that stuff through our food. And yet when I really, you know, introspectively was looking at my food and the, not only just the food itself, but the dining experiences I was creating, they weren't upholding my own values. One of my friends said this well, is that sometimes I felt we were a victim of our own success. We started out as this really small group of people, and people would come and eat and have really good conversations. And as we got more and more press, it became seamy. It became a place where people were like, oh, and then I went to this thing last weekend, you know? And that's not what I'm ever interested in making, but also it took away from the way that I wanted people to relate to one another, and also what how I felt I could relate to my diners. I was started to perform in the way that fine dining menus often have the same things on them. Someone's expecting the caviar, the wagyu, the uni, right? So you feel you have to deliver on that. And it was not only diluting my message and my food, but it was also totally removing and impacting how much I cared about my work. Like I was dissociating from my, I was just like, I don't even like what I'm doing anymore. I don't want to cook for these awful, mean people that, you know, one person came up to me and said, food was great tonight, chef, but this one server, she didn't smile all night. Like, I don't want to cook for people like that. You can't pay me enough to cook for someone like that. And so that was really ruining many things, I'm sure the dining experience, and then also my experience. So it took me some time to think about how I wanted to radically change up what I was doing. And a big part of that was also being more vulnerable myself in being more clear what I wanted. So having parameters of rules for guests and how they would interact. And then also putting more of myself into the food that might be a little bit dangerous or perhaps turn some diners off. I think being willing to accept that, you know, your cup of tea is going to really not be for everyone is an important path for, I think, anyone who's trying to find their own identity, not just in art, but I think in life. And so it took me a while to build up the confidence to say, like, this is what I'm going to put out there. And if some people don't want to be, don't want to eat it, don't want to engage with it, that's okay. So I started making more food that was a little bit more quote unquote political. One of the things that I'm really proud of is creating this series called Asian in America. It was six courses of food, had three courses of cocktails that my partner created, and it was paired with virtual reality, augmented reality. And every single course of food was a rumination of partially my experience and also larger message around the Asian American identity and how that's evolving throughout time, how that's intersecting with all these power structures within the US. So for example, talking about what the model minority myth looks like, where it comes from, what it is, and my own personal relationship with it and how it's affected my journey. And so there was very much a positive reception for that and also a very negative reception. And I think when you're getting both, that's probably a good sign. So I was proud of being able to use food in that way where not, yes, I hope that everybody thought the food was yummy, but the food experience wasn't always comfortable, and to be able to actually push people and hopefully have them have, you know, more deep and meaningful conversations at the table. At the same time, after years of doing that, bringing that all across the US in pretty unconventional spaces, we really had to build kitchens and museums and film festivals and places that sometimes that wasn't super fun. I also realized that eating in that way and experiencing and conversing in that way is great. It's also fairly passive. It is still a raising awareness. And I really wanted to do, I wanted people to do more or feel like compelled to do more, feel like they had tools and empowered to do more. And so with 2020, COVID shutting down all dining experiences, it was a little bit of a silver lining where we couldn't do the dining experiences anyway. We had a couple months to just think, what is it that this nonprofit is meant to do, and could pivot more into what we do now, which is like research, education, and then kind of like in-person and virtual kind of community building.
It very much reminds me of, this is the artful part of what you were doing. And that's the in terms of the culinary arts, you literally were creating a fully immersive experience that was intellectually engaging, as well as engaging at the level of the palate, and also at the social level of just engaging and hopefully talking across the table about issues that can be uncomfortable or new, and often uncomfortable just means new. You talked about the Asian America series, you talked about, I know you had a dish that was called the Model Minority Dish, and people can go online and learn more about it, and you talk about it in your TED Talk, your TEDx talk as well. I think you've addressed this, but I want to just put a fine pin on it. Was there a moment when you said, you know, I want to tackle, let's say, the concept of tokenism, right, on the plate? Like, I want to take this big concept that is a part of my individual lived experience. It is a societal experience in America. And I want to translate those ideas through the medium of food. And I want to break down this idea, deconstruct it almost, through the culinary arts. Was there a moment? I'm very interested in these moments that are like the sort of clarion call, like, I must do this, right? Was there a moment when you said, I want to tackle tokenism on the plate?
I don't know if there was a specific moment. It was kind of more like this is something I want to talk about. I know that food is my medium to talk about it. And how can I not just recreate it so it's a thing that you look at, but to truly have someone, as much as I can, understand or actually feel embodied in what I was feeling at that moment. I think sometimes there is a extractiveness in art, especially art made by marginalized folks, where it's a little bit of that, I'm looking for the word and it's escaping me. It's a little bit like trauma porn, where it's like, wow, that's so terrible, but it's over here. There's an arm's length away as the observer. And so how do I remove that distance and have diners actually feel the way that I felt during the time where I felt tokenized or I felt marginalized or felt othered? There was something that I created actually before I did the Asian America series, where it was called That's Disgusting. And it's served in this little metal lunchbox. And you open it up and there's a little name tag, you know, the ones that say like, hello, my name is, and it just says, that's disgusting. And all the ingredients are comprised of all these things that are now kind of seen as cool. They've been gentrified into cool things, at least. But they used to be very much either a poor man's food. So oysters, for example, they were very plentiful before we polluted all our waters. And so they were actually not seen as really fancy. Everybody was eating oysters. But now, you know, oysters are kind of this like nice thing you have by the beach or on a half shell. Things like eel or garlic chives, which when I had garlic chive dumpling growing up, people were like, oh, that smells like farts, you know. But now I was on an episode of Be Bobby Flay years ago, and Bobby Flay was like, oh yeah, garlic chives, like, you know, it's really important to use garlic chives in Chinese cooking. I'm not knocking on Bobby, like he's right, like garlic chives are important in some parts of Chinese cooking, but isn't it interesting how that it can evolve over time? And so how do you bring people not into just the educational experience of like, this food was once this and now it's this, that's still arm's length away. But how do you give them something where in order to have the food, they have to open this lunchbox and feel, hopefully, a little sense of that visceral discomfort or that shame that so many immigrants' kids like myself felt of like being embarrassed of opening your thing and having other people be like, what is that? You know, and how do you bring that to the table and, for lack of a better term, kind of force people into experiencing. I mean, that's what they signed up for. So some people don't sign up, which is fine. but yeah, so like that was kind of like the genesis of a lot of how I think about creating food is how do you develop a relationship with your diner where it's not just I speak to you and you speak back to me, but I am really involving you. I'm really immersing you. I'm really embracing you because sharing that is an act of vulnerability. And I think acts of vulnerability are of love, ultimately.
You use the word embodiment or embodied. Being embodied, right? You must be somewhere in your life in order to do the work you do. You were given enough tools, or there are people in your life who helped you to fully embody this moment, to fully embody your point of view, your voice, your talent, your intellect, all the parts of who you are. Who are those people in your life? The show is called Lifted. So I'm always interested in who are the people who lift you up, who help you to be your most full self in the world.
I think it's so important to be surrounded by people that will validate how you feel. They don't have to agree with you. They just have to validate that you are important and that your feelings are important and they're worth being paid attention to. My partner, Matt, has been always there to like, yeah, you want to experiment, you want to try, let's do it. Let's find a way to do it together. He was also the one who did all the cocktails, and he's always a big proponent of like, you know, if you're not failing, you're probably not trying very much. You know, you're not pushing yourself. You need to be failing. And we have this culture of fear of conflict, fear of failure. And it prevents so many of us from just feeling free to do something new, to feel uncomfortable. And to fail is a practice. And we should be practicing more and more. We should be practicing discomfort. We should be practicing conflict in more and more healthy, productive ways, not in unproductive ways. So I think, yes, he's hugely important. My team, we're a little team of six people at the studio now. And we had a team retreat in May. And I felt like, you know, you can feel in your body feels at rest. It feels at peace. When even when you are working, I'm like, oh, these people are incredible. I love all of them. That feels like I know I'm doing the right thing. Or even when things are really hard, you can feel in your body like, I know this is hard or this is frustrating or I didn't like this, but you're able to still have a sense of self-worth, a sense of self-confidence, a sense of identity that isn't wrapped. Like no one is saying because you couldn't do something right, you are wrong. You know, I think it's important to have those people in your life. And I feel like all my team members are like that. So it's been such an honor to work with all of them.
You shared, I believe, that your father-in-law, perhaps, the first meal that he requested after his cancer treatment was one of your dishes. Why is that important?
Yes, my father-in-law has since passed away, and he was very monumental in my partner's journey, and just such a loving, kind-hearted human. I think taught the whole family a lot of things, and I think just realizing, like, you know, he wanted my food. My mother-in-law also like very much requested, embraced my food, cultural food, but also just like food that I made for them, depending on what they liked or what they didn't like. Realizing that, like, you can truly just love and accept someone, and that's it. Like, there's no caveats, there's no conditions, there's no but only if or only when. It's just, oh, I truly love and accept you. And even in this point where I'm feeling really weak, I'm feeling, you know, demoralized from, you know, chemo and all of that, is like, that brings you a sense of comfort and stability and joy. And I think there was something, at least for me, just it felt really, really special. It made me feel very held.
Thank you. I have similar experience with in-laws across cultural lines. And when there's those moments of acceptance, when you are seen and understood and held, it is quite a beautiful thing. Because I also talk a lot about, and my origin story has grief in it, I want to know, what was one of the first or a pivotal meal that you made after a loss in your life?
Ooh, this is a hard one. I really struggled after we lost our dog, King Arthur. He passed away during COVID, which was not a great time to lose pets because it's hard to get in the vet and all that stuff. We were thankfully able to be there when they euthanized him or putting him down. And afterwards, I mean, I don't know what I did for a few days. I don't remember. But I remember making a toast and with egg and a really runny yolk. I posted about this at some point on Instagram and how it was just like the messiness of it, the gooiness of it, that it was comforting, but also like it was just, it felt incomplete. There was something about that felt fitting for the occasion. And every time I think about my doggy, we called him a mommy's dog because he like followed, he was my baby. That there's like something that feels right about that particular dish.
At the end of your days, what do you want people to say about you?
I hope that people Well, I don't know if I cared that much about people I didn't know very well, but I think for the people that I, especially that I interacted with meaningfully, that I pushed them to be burr, what is the right word? To feel that they could be themselves, that they could be their authentic selves. And hopefully that helped them feel they could live the lives that they wanted.
What would you want your last meal to be?
Oh, this is a tough one. I struggle a lot. I whiffle waffle back and forth a lot. I used to always say juicy soup dumplings, which would, I think, would of course be a great last meal, but I think I'm gonna stick with, I would just want a little bowl of like really fancy short plain white rice, probably like from Japan. There's like some really nice rice growing regions of Japan. And there's this large brand called Maggi. Maggi makes Maggi seasoning, but they have a subset of Maggi that's called Maggi Calamansi. It has calamansi, which is like a little citrus fruit that's grown in tropical regions. Anyway, literally white rice, calamansi, and I think that's it. There's just something very beautiful about the simplicity of
I love it and I want it now. I don't, it sounds
that.
absolutely delicious the way you described it. All right. Chef Jenny, I thank you so much for this conversation. It has been absolutely delightful. I champion your work in the world and I cannot wait to see what you do next.
Thank you so much for having me. This was such a lovely conversation. Truly, like, highlight of the day.
Lifted is developed, written, and produced by me and my one-woman producing team, Celia Cates. It is edited by Jamie Moss. Thank you for joining us. Stay tuned for our next inspiring episode.